there's something different about being in silence with God, where you just sit. And I, you know, and I think trusting that something comes through that is important.
Emma Mason is professor of English and Comparative Literary Studies at Warwick University in England. She's the author and editor of several books, primarily in 19th century English literature, and most recently a study titled Christina Rossetti, Poetry, Ecology, Faith. She also edits with Mark Knight the book series New Directions in Religion and Literature for Bloomsbury Press. Her current work explores Catholic women mystics of the early 20th century, which is what we discuss with her today. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Emma, my friend, it's great to see you this morning. Thank you so much for coming on here.
Thanks, Matt.
So I've been looking forward to this podcast conversation for a long time now, right? So, and you were at BYU just this past summer, about 3 months ago, for a couple of events. And I had a chance then to hear some of this exciting work you're undertaking on Catholic women mystics of the early 20th century. And I thought it was fascinating. So it's great to have you on to talk about that work and about the subject of mysticism more generally. So to contextualize the work for our listeners, much of your scholarly work has been in 19th century British literature, right? And I guess my first question for you is, how far afield is this project on 20th century Catholic women mystics, many of whom were French? Is this going way off the beaten track for you, or is this actually close in some ways?
I think they are connected. I think one of the things that I found really interesting about the connection between the 19th and the 20th century is how that periodization is often based on quite secular categories. So as soon as you sort of introduce a term like mysticism, the connections start to kind of unfold in a different sort of way. So as you say, you know, a lot of my work's been on Christina Rossetti or Wordsworth or Blake, those kind of figures who I absolutely love. I've also done some work on a Catholic poet called Elizabeth Jennings, who actually died in 2001. So she's sort of a late modernist in a way, but she wrote this incredible book called Every Changing Shape, Mystical Experience and the Making of Poems. And I read that when I was an undergraduate, and she just starts talking about all of these figures like Simone Weil and Charles Peguy and Rilke and Julian of Norwich and all these people I never heard of and certainly wasn't going to get taught on an English degree in the UK. And so I think that in between those figures, so someone like Christina Rossetti, who Jennings actually edited and sort of introduced me to Rossetti, and then Jennings on the other side, you've just got this huge number of women that are writing mystical poetry, philosophy, theology. And so I think that's where my interest kind of sat in a way. It's where it kind of got focused after I finished the book on Rossetti.
I think that's great. I love that. The idea that somehow the topic of mysticism kind of, in a way, can almost collapse time and space.
Yeah, a lovely way to put it. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. Okay, so let me ask you, before we get to the historical figures that you're taking up here, let me ask you about mysticism more generally, okay? And it's a word I want to ask you about. It's a word with a lot of baggage, right, in contemporary society. And this is true, you know, in secular and religious communities, it has a lot of baggage, right? So I find the tradition, the mystical tradition, fascinating and often deeply inspiring. But if I were to go into my own religious congregation and use the word mystical, I need to quickly explain what I meant by it, because I'd have people in my congregation saying, he means mystification, right, as opposed to the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ or something like this. And that's to say nothing, right, of secular friends of the profession, right? We're like, mysticism, what, right? So yeah. I guess I'm going to ask you this. Do you like the term mysticism? And do the early 20th century Catholic women figures about whom you write like that term? And if you like it and they like it, do you both like it for the same reasons?
Well, I do like the word mysticism. I think I have spent quite a bit of my career not liking the word mysticism and being a bit nervous about it. I think partly because it often points to a kind of non-religious experience. It's often associated with a kind of altered state of consciousness that isn't really to do with religion and is to do with, you know, a completely different sort of secular world. And actually, a lot of that secular mysticism, I think, is just beyond me. It's a bit too cool. It's just, you know, it's, that's not really what I'm interested in. I think historically, there's a lot of work that has said, oh, you know, mysticism isn't really a word that anybody understands until maybe the 17th century, or maybe it's the 19th century, depending on who you read. But actually, one of the things that I found about going into my own faith as a Catholic and really thinking about where that faith came from, particularly its kind of Jewish origins, mysticism is there, you know, from the start. And I think that the meaning of it as a word that means to close the eyes, close the lips, be in silence, try and relate to this invisible God, to me, that, it, you know, really sums up what is kind of important to me about faith. And it sort of strips back some of the other maybe ideological questions that people sort of struggle with around religion. So I think mysticism can be a really powerful word. The thing that these women have taught me, that I'm working on at the moment, so these figures who are writing at the sort of the end of the 19th century into the 20th century, what they've taught me is that mysticism for them is not extraordinary. It is not a flight of fancy. It is not a unique experience. It's not something that you have a sort of momentary vision from heaven. It is an everyday experience of the presence of God. It is an everyday being with God. That's what mysticism is for them, because they're kind of going to that really ancient meaning of it as silence and contemplation. So I now do share that with them, having learned that from them.
That's a great response. And I love the way you underscore both the religious tradition, the religion to which mysticism is deeply attached. Like you, I'm not a fan of the kind of the vague secular kind of idea, because like attachment to whatever it may be. I the religious component is very important to me. But also the everyday aspect of it, right? The silence aspect of it, the contemplative aspect of it. The scholar, the great scholar on the mystical tradition, Bernard or Bernie McGinn, he has this anthology of the mystical tradition. He tries to sort of define down what mysticism is. Here's what he writes. I'm curious to get your response to this. He defines mysticism as, quoting McGinn here, that part or element of Christian belief and practice that concerns the preparation for, the consciousness of, and the effect of what the mystics themselves have described as a direct and transformative presence of God. Here's my question for you. I mean, I guess, do you like that definition? And second, do you at all, do you contrast, or do you really bring into the same frame the idea of the transformative presence and the everyday presence?
Yeah. Well, I should say first that Bernard McGinn's work is just extraordinary. I mean, you know, his canon is the most incredible scholarly achievement I think I have seen in any field. His anthologies and histories of the subject are the reason that I can do anything with it at all. So I do like his definition a lot. I think what I would want to do is emphasize the last part of it, which is the mysticism being in the presence of God, more than the transformative part of it. Because I think one is always transformed through faith, but as a kind of everyday practice that is always there, I think that focus on being in the presence rather than experiencing God and then being transformed is what's important to me. And I'll say that I think the idea of religious experience is a really difficult one for me. I used to use the word experience all the time, and I liked the word experience and the kind of experiential sense until I really started to understand its meaning as, well, that sort of root meaning that it has as a test or a trial, sort of, you know, experimenting, experiencing. And now the word's been completely taken over by these like horrible experience days and experience gifts and, you know, as if, you know, God could be this an experience. So I think the kind of sense of the presence and the being with, and the fact that God is a, you know, not something to test, is a trusted and everyday encounter, not a one-off event. That I think that's where that definition would sort of fall for me. But again, I think I've only got there by reading some of these women that I'm working on.
Okay, great. You know, the first book I ever wrote was actually on the topic of experience, and it's not a religious book, though my interest in it was born in my own religious background. And the thing that I kind of got onto was the way that the the early 20th century German thinkers, not the women mystics, right? But the people like, you know, Theodor Adorno and Walter Benjamin. We're talking about the break between one word in French for experience, Erfahrung, and the newer 19th century term, Erlebnis, right? And they kind of would try to explain, right, that these two words are really important to understand in relation to each other, because it gets away from some of what you're talking about, the notion of kind of like this trial, this grand, you know, kind of like experiential, just sort of trial of whatever, experimentation. Yeah. Anyway, that's an aside. Just
That's interesting. And I like the word experience if I'm talking about something else, like poetry. I think I have an experience of poetry, music, dance, you know, people, experiences of nature, the sea. Of course, they're important and wonderful. I just think that, yeah, God is a separate category, perhaps, in relation to this question of mysticism.
Okay, great. One more question I'm going to ask you before we go into some of the women that you write about. Given the way you describe mysticism, how loosely or tightly do you use that term to describe people's experience in the present? Would you say that you yourself understand firsthand something of mysticism in your own practice, or is there a threshold kind of required above which it qualifies as mysticism, but that's not what most people would experience, or if I use the word experience, most people would encounter in everyday life?
I don't think that I have had a mystical experience myself yet, but I think I have met a lot of people who I would say are mystical. Now, whether they think that they're mystical is a different question, but I'm identifying here, I think, various people within my own church community. I go to a church in the town of Warwick, and it's a very friendly, well-attended Catholic church. And there are a few people there that I've met just through talking about books we've read, but also there's a wonderful sister who comes, Sister Felicity. And I'm sure she would not call herself a mystic and would be in many ways devastated to be talked about at all. But she is just a model in a way of the kind of bringing God's presence into being. But I think that from sort of, you know, gleaning about her, that's taken her years. I mean, she's a nun, you know, she's in prayer all the time. So I think that, you know, mysticism is something that one can get to. And of course, I'm also very aware of the many people that I think, particularly in the 1960s and 70s, were kind of saying mysticism is the future of Christianity. So someone like Thomas Merton or Karl Rahner says that, but there's several figures that are constantly saying this is the only way we're going to continue the Christian faith. They are all Catholics, and so they're probably thinking about their own church too. And I'm sure there are other ways that Christianity will always continue. But I think within the Catholic tradition, there's something about the mystical focus on everyday silence and just sort of carefulness and thoughtfulness and slowness of being and thinking that does, you know, maybe is even more important now than it used to be, because of the speed of everything that happens now and the speed of life. And, you know, there's the sort of modern situation that we're in now, which is very similar to that modern situation that I think the women that I'm looking at were confronting. You know, they were at the beginning of a kind of modernity, which is now, you know, on another level. So I do see mysticism as something that is perceived as a kind of magical, faraway experience that people only get if they kind of do a particular kind of thing or say a particular kind of spell or invoke it in a particular, but I don't think it means that. And I don't think it means that for many of the writers that I'm interested in. I don't think it means that for Thomas Merton, for example, you know, who is one of the many translators of Raisa Maritain, who's one of the women that I'm working on. So yeah, I do think it's a word that still has meaning now. And I think it's an important word precisely because it doesn't really sound very modern.
That's a great way to put it. And I would agree. And you mentioned, you know, kind of the speed of the modern world, right? And the importance of what that tradition suggests is the need to sort of slow down and to really go inward and to ponder, to meditate, to contemplate, to connect. You know, so much of the modern world about speed and disconnection, right? Atomization. And there's something about the practice of the mystics, which seems, I do believe, more relevant than ever. And some people said for the, at least trying to channel something of an everyday experience of God that I think is incredibly healthy in a climate when, if you're not getting it from some higher source, you're probably getting it from social media, and that does not go good places.
No, yeah. No. And I mean, there was a point, I think, about 15 years ago, where lots of big corporations, including some universities, wanted to start introducing meditation into the workplace. So you would sit and do some kind of mind, body, spirit, vague thing where people would sit together and be in silence. I'm all for that. I'm all for kind of secular versions of breathing and meditation. But I have noticed that it's completely fizzled out. You know, it doesn't happen in any of the spaces that I was seeing it happen. And I think, again, that's partly this problem of what happens when you detach terms like mysticism or even a term like spirituality from God. You then end up with a kind of a nothingness. It's not a negation. It's a nothingness. And I think one of the kind of gifts of the idea of mysticism is that you don't have to do anything. You do just sit there and be quiet. You don't have to be counting your breaths, and you don't have to be making a list of the sounds that you hear. I mean, all of those things can be helpful, and they're, you know, about attention and observation, and I think they're useful, but there's something different about being in silence with God where you just sit. And I, you know, and I think trusting that something comes through that is important.
Okay, that's great. Transition, I suppose, into these women mystics you write about, right? Mm-hmm. Who did precisely that, right? And you sent me a couple of short pieces. I know they're part of a larger project, and I love that project, and I love these short pieces. And to help us, our listeners, sort of understand this, you sent me pieces on Edith Stein and Raissa Maritain, right? And Stein may be better known to some of our listeners than the Maritain, but both are important. I wonder if you can give us a brief sketch of those two women and why they figure into the larger study.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's worth sort of focusing on those two women as well, because they are quite connected in many ways. They're both born into Jewish families. They're both born at the end of the 19th century. They both later convert to Catholicism, but are strongly identify still as Jewish. So they perceive themselves to be Jewish Catholics. They're both intellectuals. Stein studies philosophy with the great phenomenologist Edmund Husserl, and her her famous classmate is Martin Heidegger, who always gets a bit more attention, maybe not so much now. And she then is, you know, does her PhD with Husserl on empathy, becomes his research assistant, and then, you know, is unable to get a job, partly because she's Jewish, culturally Jewish, even though she's thinking about converting at that point. And she converts and then quite quickly becomes a Carmelite nun. And from the space of the convent, she takes the name Teresa after the mystic Teresa of Avila, and writes several books of poetry, philosophy and theology predominantly, quite a lot on women's education as well, which is really important, and then some poems. And she is then murdered in Auschwitz in 1942. And Maritain, who is born in Russia and then moves to France when she's 10, has a quite similar trajectory, although she does marry the famous philosopher Jacques Maritain. They are also kind of terrified of being sent to the camps, but are able to kind of evade that in a different kind of way and able to escape from it. She is intensely contemplative and has a really an almost monastic prayer life. Her marriage to Jacques Maritain is mainly a chaste marriage, because she really wants to try and find a way to be a contemplative at home. So she lives with him, her sister, and they have a sort of community around them. They they occasionally hold these very interesting conferences on different philosophical ideas, and meet Stein at one of those. And so Stein actually does write to Jacques and Reicha at that time. So that's, I think, a sort of brief background to them. But I would say that there just are these huge number of other women who are doing something very similar. It's mainly France and Germany, but also the UK. And they are, many of them are converting to Catholicism, and they're using it as a way, as a foundation for this sort of creative theological writing through which they can directly and indirectly explore what they perceive to be the utter horror of their moment, that they cannot believe is happening. They just absolutely cannot believe it's happening. And I find it very moving that that's what they turn to as a way to try and redress what's going on.
I find it fascinating. And it reminds me, I mean, there's the very well-known Simone Weil, right? Kind of Jewish, yes, evocatively Catholic, didn't convert, I suppose, formally, but did affectively, certainly. Mm-hmm. You know, later in the century, Denise Levertov, right? The, yes, poet who's responding now not to kind of on the ground World War II, but responding to the horrors of Vietnam, what comes out of it. So there's a theme here, which I find just really compelling. Because, yeah, you said earlier this great thing, but that when you talk about mysticism, you kind of suddenly you kind of connect across centuries and places, mm-hmm, and spaces. Let me ask you then about Edith Stein, because she comes on the scene during a time when you have writers like Virginia Woolf and James Joyce, William Butler Yeats, and others, right? And these are people who are seeking forms of transcendence that are freed from what they see as the fetters of religion, yeah, right? Now, Stein is a poet who's not seeking that kind of freedom from religion. She's finding, mm-hmm, freedom through religion.
Yeah.
If you were to, yeah, pick up a collection of poems and you began reading them, could you date them to the early 20th century and say these have kind of an evocatively, mm-hmm, modernist quality? Or is there something distinctly different about her work that seems not altogether to belong to its era?
I think some of her hymns sound quite Victorian, or sort of the 19th century. They sound like 19th century hymns. Many of her poems, however, do sound a bit like reading Rilke, you know, and I think it does depend who translates them. I think there are various people who are retranslating some of Stein's poetry at the moment, and I think there's quite a lot of it that we don't have yet, as in it's stuck in an archive somewhere and it just hasn't been published. But I think it does have a kind of modernist rhythm, sort of sonic texture. It can be quite sparse, you know, it's not always reliant on a kind of stable rhyme scheme, for example. So it does sound modern, but it doesn't really sound like Yeats or Woolf, or, you know, I mean, I often think, what would it have been like to have read some of these women instead of Virginia Woolf, you know, or Catherine Mansfield, or, you know, who give us a very particular kind of modernism. And there's this other kind of modernism which is perhaps even more widespread. I mean, you see that in the incredible Catholic Women's Writing series, which is a series of novels that have been republished by Catholic women by the Catholic University of America Press. And I mean, that there's so many amazing novelists there, you know, Carol Hauslander, who's somebody that I do talk about in the book as well. Yeah, I mean, it would be sort of incredible to be reading them. Now, whether or not you could make an argument for getting rid of Woolf on a syllabus and putting Stein on, I mean, I think that argument would be easy to make. Stein's written far more, and it's much more original and interesting, but that would be my personal perspective. Also, you know, we've kind of read Virginia Woolf for quite a long time now. Maybe we could have a break and read Stein instead.
Why not? I love teaching Woolf, but I've not taught Stein, but I should. I taught John of the Cross, and I went back to Stein to prepare to teach John of the Cross. And I thought that her work, The Science of the Cross, is, you know, it's an extraordinary piece of thinking and writing. It's amazing, right? You mentioned this also, but this is also the modernist narrative, right? Is the narrative, mm-hmm, about kind of like aesthetic transcendence as opposed to religious transcendence. But you point out in one of these papers you sent me that during the time in the early 20th century, the Catholic Church was actually growing quite significantly, right? So it's not as though people are leaving religion for some alternative, quite the contrary, which makes Stein in some ways more representative than a lot of the high modernists.
Yes, and I would say one of the other really interesting things for me has been to see how positive the church is for these women. The church is a benevolent framework for their mystical and prayer practice. So many histories of it, until quite recently, I think, where things are, you know, history is a bit sort of more nuanced on this period. But, you know, the Catholic Church is seen as a repressive magisterium. It doesn't like mysticism, is often the narrative. It's much more interested in situating the church as a visible presence, not an invisible presence. And of course, some of that is true. It's pushing itself as a visible presence. It is very critical of modernism. You know, there's an interesting story there that many people have told about the church's relationship with modernism. But in fact, it is very interested in mysticism. You know, the church from the 19th century into the 20th century, it is reasserting the value of revelation, mysticism, the Immaculate Conception, the Sacred Heart, these kind of emotive ways into religion that I think people find very important. So I think that has been really kind of incredible for me to see, especially as a kind of Catholic, where I think sometimes in academic settings, when you know you identify in that way, there's a slight nervousness that maybe you're conservative, you're sort of secretly conservative in this liberal environment. You know, I think these women are very radical thinkers. You know, they are very radical. They are in many ways socialist, if not Marxist, but in a Catholic framework that for them is what's so enabling. And so, I think that they are part of the movement that we've often associated more with someone like Chesterton or Tolkien, where they see the church as a kind of good thing, as a kind of, you know, a tree that you plant and that kind of pins you to the spot of your faith, and that's a good thing for them. That is the case for these women too. They're not really finding it a conservative phenomenon. Now, there are women that do find it conservative, but not these women I'm looking at.
Yeah, I think the church messes with politics in all kinds of ways. Just this morning, I'm actually exercise at home. I've got a rowing machine, okay, and I'm watching yesterday some stories. And I there was a story that ran yesterday on the program in America, CBS This Morning, about a new large mural that was painted in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, and it had the Cardinal Timothy Dolan on there, a well-known conservative, talking about the importance of being open to immigration. Which, you know, in this country is flagged liberal, and of course that's not, which just shows that the church kind of cuts in its own oblique way across these categories in ways I find really healthy, especially the more polarized we get in our Western societies, the more the politics of the church, i.e. oblique and scrambling, strikes me as being profoundly significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was very clear in all the work Pope Francis did on environmentalism. You know, climate change is the big topic that in some ways, whatever perspective you're coming from, unless it's something quite marginal, you know, you're seeing climate change as an important issue. And the church was able, again, I think, to sort of really identify that, you know, this is a problem that is affecting the poorest people in the world. You know, the big problems always affect the poor first. And that's something that the Gospels are very clear about and kind of remind us of. And I think mysticism can be really helpful in that arena too, because sometimes it is perceived in a kind of Mary Martha way, where you've got kind of mystics over here praying, and then you've got the kind of activists, the liberation theologians over here doing something else. But of course, those two things, as the Mary and Martha story shows, are completely intertwined. And, you know, I think, you know, one of the kind of encyclicals that comes out in the 1940s that, you know, was very sort of influential on some of the women, I think not necessarily Stein, because I think she died at this point, but this encyclical Mystici Corporis Christi, that, you know, all Christians are kind of members of this mystical body of Christ, i.e. the church. And, you know, that the encyclical is absolutely clear that this is a response to The vanity and emptiness of earthly things, that's the phrase that's used. The vanity and earthliness, at a time when cities, towns, and fertile fields are strewn with massive ruins and defiled with the blood of brothers. That's political, but it's also kind of beyond a kind of partisan politics into something that is, much greater. And I think that's where the sort of the mystical and the political are, nicely compatible rather than sort of splitting into to two there.
Ask you about prayer here. Stein writes beautifully about prayer and what you describe as freedom of the soul and what she calls a liberation from the impediment and fatigue of thoughts and ideas.
Yeah.
Interesting phrase. She adds that the soul is like, quoting her again, a vessel into which flows the Spirit of God, but only if we're open to it. And minus that openness, and this is you remarking it, you say the experience of God becomes apophatic. Now, I find that observation fascinating because many people regard apophaticism, the inability to speak fully to an experience of God, as being a hallmark of our experience of the divine, right? But Stein believed, am I right, that if we're open to God's spirit and grace, we can bring our experience of God to expression?
Yes. Well, I think what she's interested in are intellectual frameworks in which you can find language and terms to name these ideas, like the soul, that otherwise are just going to get lost, or simply become metaphors. And once they become metaphors or similes or symbols, they then kind of, disappear, because as we have seen more recently, the arts often is kind of pushed off the agenda by whatever powers that be at any given time. So if you sort of push relations with God always into a kind of something that's representative or secondhand, you lose the kind of firsthand importance of it. And I think that's one of the reasons that she likes phenomenology so much, because it's that sort of focus on the essences of phenomena that then makes space for this search for the essence of God, which one only sort of really feels through the soul. But at the same time, I think, as you gestured to, Matt, it's not necessarily about succeeding in that expression. It's about the sort of embodying the attempt to do it. And I think actually that the sort of best analogy for me is an analogy from William Wordsworth, the poet, where he calls his brother John a silent poet. Now, John was notoriously not good at writing. He didn't write any poetry. He wasn't a very good letter writer. He was very, very shy. There's all these stories of how he would go, to visit people and wait outside the door of the house for ages because he didn't know how to kind of introduce himself. He was a naval captain. He died rescuing his crew from a ship that was sinking. But for Wordsworth, John is like the poet. He's the silent poet because he kind of embodies poetry in his way of being. He's a gentle and caring guy. And so I think for me, that is sort of partly what Stein's looking at towards too. This sort of sense of, the attempt to get there ends up in silence, which is then where you really do connect to God. But if you don't make the attempt, you're just in silence and you're then just in nothingness.
That's beautiful. A silent poet and all that signifies. That's brilliant. I know people who I describe as having that kind of silent poetic quality to them. And they themselves are kind of like metaphor, if you go back to the etymology, it means kind of a bridge or a link to cross something, who are bridges to some kind of higher state of being as a function of the persons they are. Okay, this is great, which leads me to a question about poetry, actually. And this is kind of a good transition from Stein to Reich and Maritain. Yeah. So Stein composes some beautiful poetry, and you included a couple of these in what you sent me. One of them is this great poem. It's a short poem that begins, "Who are you, sweet light?" I mean, would you read that? Do you have that in front of you? If you'd read that, and then I've got a couple of questions for you about it.
Yeah, no worries. So this is a poem called Seven Beams from a Pentecost Novena. And as your listeners will know, a novena is a prayer that's prayed over 9 days. So there are nine poems, and this is the first one within it. Who are you, sweet light, that fills me and illumines the darkness of my heart? You guide me like a mother's hand, and if you let me go, I could not take another step. You are the space that surrounds and contains my being. Without you, it would sink into the abyss of nothingness from which you raised it into being. You, closer to me than I to myself, more inward than my innermost being, and yet unreachable, untouchable, and bursting the confines of any name. Holy Spirit, eternal love.
I think that's a beautiful poem.
Yes.
Several things there stand out to me. And, you know, the association of God with light, the mother's hand, the sense of encompassing space all around the poet, the closeness so intimate to the poet that it remains mysterious to her. And these are all metaphors, and they all ring true individually, but in relation to each other, this is what I found interesting. They suggest that the truth of the poet's experience of God is found less in any single metaphor than in the power, like you said earlier, the power to embody forth and to continue the process of naming, right? Does that ring true? Does that seem right? Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, no, I think that's a lovely way to put it. And I think, again, it is sort of about a sort of daily act of being faithful, is sort of trying out these names and explanations for God in poetry, philosophy, theology, with others, the ability to kind of have groups and conversations about this, and sort of knowing that those metaphors are going to fail, you know, and that that's a good thing. That kind of failure is where we then lose our sense of authority and ego, and then enter this state of being, this word being that she is, that Stein is so invested in. Partly, you know, Heidegger is kind of someone that's influential on her, in that, you know, he's there saying that this is an important term, but I mean, she's looking at it in such a different way to him, because it's a word that is about imagining and reimagining God with others in a kind of, you know, broad religious community, both the Church Catholic and those that are immediately in front of you. So yeah, I think that focus on the sort of, you know, the metaphorical and the poetic, it's important for Stein, but I will say, you know, if you sort of put into some kind of search engine, you know, poetry and mysticism, you're going to find a huge glut of books with those words in the title that are written from about 1880 into about sort of 1940, 50. It's just, the two are just kind of seen as almost the same. So, you know, I think it's not a surprise that these women are turning to the poem to try and, you know, capture these ideas.
Okay, so that's a great transition then for me to ask you about Raisha Maritain, who writes very powerfully, right, about poetry's relationship with mystical experience. Mm-hmm. And I actually had read that short piece she'd written about. It's a chapter, it's an essay, Poetry as Spiritual Experience or something. I'd read it years ago and forgotten it was her. Anyway, so I was grateful to be reintroduced to that piece through what you sent me. But so you observe, and this is, I'm quoting you here, that like many early 20th century Catholic thinkers, Raisha found in the mystical contemplation of God and creation a process essential to voicing the trauma of violence and power. Now, you mentioned this earlier too, right? The women responding to this horror around them. Now, Theodore Adorno famously wrote, right, the poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. But it seems that for Maritain and others, poetry during the wars was not only barbaric, but vital, necessary, right? I mean, is that true? Yes, no? I mean, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, without a question, the poem is this space of, I think, intellectual freedom, affectivity. It's about conjuring this encounter with God's presence without it falling into just simply the supernatural. So, you know, the ghost story is also very popular at this time. And I love a good ghost story as much as anybody else. You know, it's Halloween's coming up. It'll be great. But I mean, that is not what these women are interested in. And you can see that they've got the same kind of worry about the gothic and the ghost stories as actually Wordsworth had when he was talking in the preface to the Lyrical Ballads, where he sort of sees it as a kind of false kind of feeling. And it's also a kind of, it's fictionalized. And I think that's one of the other sort of tricky things for looking at these women and why they think their work is able to address these very horrific kind of moments of violence that they're experiencing around them, is that, you know, God is a real presence and the work that they're doing has a real effect. It's not fiction. It's not something that's kind of something that you do when you get home for fun. Something, you know, I mean, it's sort of, they would be in tune with that Adornian line, you know, when Adorno is asked, you know, what do you do in your free time? I have no hobbies. Of course, you know, he's one of the greatest pianists of the period, but nothing is a hobby. Everything is real and you know, imbued with this kind of importance and power. And I think that sense of making sure that the poem launches one into the experience, the presence of God, rather than replaces that experience, becomes very important for them.
Great. I love that you said that there's something deeply real about this experience, right? Because Raish Samaritan upholds what she calls this mystical realism, which is a great, and for some, it would seem almost an oxymoronic phrase, right? I mean, mystical realism, I mean, there's so many other terms that one could use, right? Mystical encounter, mystical experience, mystical union. That mystical realism insists on the actuality of the thing that one is undergoing. Right, in these kinds of states of silence and connectedness. That on that, you say she practiced a form of contemplative prayer that she called deep absorption.
Yes.
If you can speak to that's a great phrase, deep absorption.
Yeah. I mean, I think she calls it deep absorption. She also quiet absorption. It's sort of this, I think it's this point where she wants to find a way of praying that makes clear that God isn't a metaphor or a symbol, it isn't a bridge to something else, that God is the presence around her. And when I've talked to students about this, I have sometimes used that David Foster Wallace line in This Is Water, his short essay, where, you know, he opens it with the kind of the fish. There's an older fish swimming and the two young fish swim by and the older fish is like, hi, you know, how's the water? And the young fish swim on and they're like, what's water? And I think, you know, for Raisha, you know, the water is God. God is everything. You don't need to kind of convince yourself to believe in it or trust in it. You don't need to sort of sit around having a kind of existential crisis about what it is or what it means. It just is there, and just absorb yourself in it, and then there's the evidence that you need. You know, it's going to be there. But I mean, it does come from God for her. So absorption isn't, you know, yes, you can prepare for it. I think she does prepare for it by, she reads a huge amount, as all of these women do. She's writing poetry. She attends mass very regularly, often more than once a day. But I think she has this actually this quite interesting quote from her journal, where she talks about these two different kinds of absorption. And she says, in the first, the eyes remain open, the intellect is enlightened, and the soul is in a kind of ecstasy. And then she says, in the second, the eyes are closed, the intellect receives nothing. All the affections of the will are focused in a single point and united to God. So there's, again, it's a kind of letting go, but you kind of need both of them to make it work.
I think that's beautiful. I love it. Yeah, the experience of God in multiple registers, right?
Yeah.
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Let me ask you another experience that she records. Again, I'm now leery using the word experience, Emma, after our earlier.
Yeah, no, I know. Right. Me too. I can use it as well. It's hard.
Right. So she writes about this vision she has, right? She and I'm quoting here, which you included in the piece you sent me. Rome was not far from the Piazza di Spagna in the midst of a thick and restless crowd. We were anxious. Was war coming? Then to the left in the sky appeared a mass of light. As it came, it looked at first like a mass of stars. The stars gradually increased in size, and we saw they were a cohort of angels. And all at once the angels were among us. They marched in closed ranks like an army of young men clothed in black and white. Grace and joy spread everywhere as they passed. Now, that reminds me of that episode in 2 Kings chapter 6, right, when Elisha mm-hmm. opens the spiritual eyes of the king of Israel and shows the king how, despite his army being surrounded with enemies, the angels also encompass and protect the king's armies, leading to the famous declaration, fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. Is that the implication of that vision of Rachel's, or is that different?
No, I think that's absolutely right. You know, that's a really great text to sort of bring in, because I suppose in that passage, you know, we see Elisha really praying for protection, and he's able to connect with God, not because he's asking for anything to change, but because he wants to see what's there. And I guess that, again, is the kind of realism of the mystic. You know, it's not a running away from reality. It's a way of allowing God to help us in that moment. And of course, for Rasha in particular, who is from this Hasidic family and really is very, you know, remains very interested in her Hasidic grandfather and the sort of the background, she's very captured by passages that kind of evoke that kind of chariot mysticism of the kind that you get in this passage and also in Ezekiel. So that there's a sort of marrying there too of that kind of Merkava plus Catholic that she's finding. So yeah, that's a really great allusion, I think, in that passage. And I love that she's in kind of Rome with all of these people who are just like absolutely, you know, freaked out about is war coming, and you feel the sort of horror and the need to sort of turn to God. And I think it's not a desperate turn to God, it's a kind of, again, it's like a trusting turn to God that I think, you know, it inspiring.
I love it. Whole work that you're doing on these Catholic women mystics, I think is fantastic. I'm already a little bit upset the book is not already out. So
yeah, me too.
Get writing, Emma. Get writing. Yeah. Let me close with a couple sets of questions and kind of conclusion here. I want to ask you. The first, you know, as you thought about it, is there a lesson or two that we could take from these remarkable 20th century Catholic mm-hmm. mystics, Edith Stein and Rachel Maritain and others you're writing about? Is there a reason why they seem especially relevant now, or is the value of this project for you rooted more in the desire to ensure that they aren't just forgotten?
I think they're really relevant now. I don't think it's just a reclamation project, although part of it is that. I think that their relevance is in shifting our understanding of passionate feeling about God. So for example, one of the images that often gets used when we think about mysticism is the Bernini altarpiece of St. Teresa, where she's in this kind of ecstasy. It's a kind of passionate and raw sort of jouissance. I think that Stein would say, you know, that isn't really what mysticism is. I mean, she talks about it, and again, this is another quote from Stein. She talks about it as being, quote, weighted down and settled in the cell. And, you know, I love the Bernini sculpture, of course, but I think there is possibly a different perspective coming here from women who want to say, you know, this mysticism is like a soft ecstasy. It's like a kind of feeling okay. There is a sort of meditative, you know, almost Zen-like, but within the frame of the Catholic Church, again, a bit like the kind of work Thomas Merton was doing. You know, I think that hope for a state of being okay is really important in a world where a lot of people don't feel okay. And a lot of people aren't okay for very material reasons, but a lot of people that are kind of materially sort of all right are also not okay.
Amen to that. Yeah. So let me conclude then with this. A brief anecdote first, told to me years ago by the person who was the department chair and was hired into the Department of English here mm-hmm. at BYU 25 years ago. This is a man named John Tanner, mm-hmm. who was a distinguished Miltonist, but also somebody who's written very extensively and very well about my own faith tradition, that of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And mm-hmm. he described being at a conference and years ago of Miltonists. And religion came up, and one of his colleagues, a much published and distinguished Milton scholar, said to him, you know, John, I just don't understand why we still need religion, what it's good for today. And John said that he was really taken with the question and wanted to actually interrogate its very premise, that religion is just about our need or what it's good for. And I guess I'm wondering about the same thing when it comes to mysticism. I mean, is it fair to ask, you know, what mysticism is good for in our own moment? Or is it more accurate to say that mysticism in its own way a record of our human engagement of or encounter with God, and that we can only ever determine after the fact what the usefulness of mysticism is?
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, certainly mysticism is a form of peacefulness. It is a form of calm, a sort of freedom from anxiety and fury and jealousy and greed. And I guess even if, you know, we're able to use that momentarily, that's a positive thing. But also I think that what the mystic does is remind us that the question of, you know, do we need religion, or even Heidegger's question, you know, why is there something and not nothing? You know, these just are completely redundant questions for these women. It's just there. It's what would be sort of like saying, you know, do we really need oxygen? Do we really need water? Well, you know, regardless of, maybe we will invent ways to do that in the future, I dare say. But I think there is a sense for these women that, you know, God transcends even that. That there is just, it's just there. There's no need to second guess. There's only a need to trust. And of course, that comes with huge struggle and huge dark nights of the soul. That these are not women that are kind of blissfully happy all the time. That, you know, Raisa does suffer from, I think, a sort of form of depression. Stein, you know, goes quite willingly into the camps with her sister. And I'm sure that took a lot to do that. You know, she goes to join her people, as she says, and is trying to actually have a prisoner swap so that she can go in and swap out for someone else. Then they're not people that are retreating from the world, but they are people that are saying, here is, you know, God is here and tells us to love one another. And that's a sort of non-negotiable. We don't really need to think about whether it's right or wrong or good or bad. That's just what it is. And of course, you know, humans as they are want to kind of put labels on it, and they want to say it's this or that. But I think they bring a kind of simplicity to faith, which, you know, of course, from that simplicity comes this amazing kind of richness and nuance.
This has been such a joy for me to talk with you, Emma. This is so rich. This is such wonderful work. I love your insights into not only these particular women, mystics and writers, but into, you know, what it means to engage large questions and experiences of God. I bravo you. Keep up the great work. And I look forward to seeing you out here sometime soon.
Thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate you having me on. It's a real pleasure to talk to somebody who wants to take these ideas so seriously. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Kate Thorpe. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.